Coming up, actress Julie Ann Emery joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV show.
Hello, everyone. I am Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody. I'm Facebook Living this
time. Awesome.
Yes.
I'm excited that Julie Ann Emery here is here because we can bang it out. Girls with bangs, my favorite thing. Okay, I'm not going to waste time. We have so much to talk about.
Yeah, you guys were talking so much before we even sat down. So
I know. We were
got things to say.
So much to talk about. So first off, I'm post Storm Irma.
Yes.
Because I was going to the Bogart Estate Film Festival, October 17th to the 23rd. They were afraid that Key Largo was going to be completely destroyed.
Yeah.
The African Queen, the original boat, but miraculously, it is. It's okay. The festival is on.
Oh, that's
so
amazing!
I'm really excited because obviously tourism in a place like that is so important. I was thrilled to hear the Hemingway cats are okay.
Oh, yay!
And also, I thought it was very lovely. You know, they always make fun of actors and stuff, but I thought it was very touching seeing all the actors on the phone, and you seeing
during the telethon, yeah,
to raise money. I mm-hmm. thought that was very, touching and
but
wonderful.
But think about what if you are a Susie Homemaker sitting in your living room and going, you know what, I really do want to make a contribution now. And you call up and you get, Ryan Reynolds on the phone. That's pretty exciting.
I mean, I wonder if they do that, if they say, if I get Barbara Streisand, I'll give you $1,000.
Right. Maybe.
Who knows? Maybe they do. Maybe they do that. But I thought it was very, I feel like the future of us all hopefully getting back together and being a sort of universal country again is it has to come from individuals.
Yeah.
It can't come from the government and or our leaders. Not that I'm promoting anarchy, just actors, just celebrities.
Just celebrity anarchy.
But it's been very eventful. And then last week I was spoke at the Jerry Lewis Memorial in Las Vegas, incredibly touching, and it was really an honor to speak specifically on his films and his relationship with TCM and his legacy, mm-hmm. which is which is incredible. So it was quite an honor to be there, and now I'm gonna go off to shoot Trailblazing Women.
Yes, you've got Trailblazing
TCM.
Women coming up.
We've got some exciting this year. We are saluting editors, writers, and producers. So people
fabulous.
You literally never hear
see.
About.
Yeah,
and I'm very excited. We've got some great co-hosts and some great movies. So I've been boning up, watching all of my movies.
And when do they start airing?
They'll start airing it in October.
Okay.
But we were going to shoot last week, and the storm
knocked
us out. So we'll be coming up and doing that.
That's exciting. How many episodes are you doing for that?
It airs all month on October. So once I don't know what day, but once a week in October, and there'll be about 25 films that we will introduce,
mm-hmm.
and I'll have a co-host, and we'll. And we're honoring, just some of the great editors, writers, producers. I mean, from modern day people like Kathleen Kennedy to this woman, June Mathis. I mean, I'm in my back to school theme. If everybody out there wants to go Google June Mathis, mm-hmm. one of the most, what I love about the show is I learn so much each year. And June Mathis was a writer, producer, director. She discovered Valentino. She's actually
she's
buried next to him. But wrote and produced, of course, hundreds and hundreds of films. But also the first Ben-Hur. And so all the stuff, the chariot race, right. and epic, and it's the largest extras in any film period. There's 10,000
No
people.
Way.
They literally, apparently the story goes that like Joan Crawford's in the movie Clark Gable, like they just needed people
any
around the
bodies.
Clock.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she managed, you know, she wrote and produced, there was another writer named Bess Meredith, and we cover her. But it's so funny because, again, in the context of today, you'd say, well, a woman can't handle an epic film like this. And here was Ben-Hur.
The epic.
Yeah, it couldn't have been any further than a woman's film. But so some of the women from the silent era, great editors, of course, were doing Thelma Schoonmaker, Lindsay Klingman, who cut One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ann Coates, who cut Lawrence of Arabia, Susan Morse, who had a 20-year relationship with editing relationship with Woody Allen. So it's really incredible. I'm very, very excited
wow.
to be talking. Oh, and then also people like Joan Harrison, who worked hand-in-hand with Alfred Hitchcock. Virginia Van Upp is another great, if you want to Google her, fantastic. She was one of the first female executives at Columbia, and worked under notoriously Harry Cohn. She wrote and produced Gilda. I mean,
wow,
yeah, incredible, right? I mean, we don't think of, you know, her, you know, producers in those days really had quite a hand in the mm-hmm. in the script, and mm-hmm. she molded Rita Hayworth's, you know, which is undeniably Gilda's her finest,
absolutely.
And so she molded, she helped, you know, really mold that image. And so with each one of these people, Marcia Lucas, who edited Star Wars. Taxi Driver.
A little movie called Star Wars.
It's incredible. Again, you see the fingerprints of these women. You know, I love doing the show. I think it's so important because it's not like it's hard to find. We find so many women, and it's just that you've never heard of them.
Right.
You know, like no one's ever heard of June Mathis. So you have to start talking about some of these women. It's just incredible.
I love that you're doing the show, and I love that it's called Trailblazing Women, because truly that is what, you know, that's what you're highlighting.
Yeah.
And it's incredible the things that you learn watching it.
Yes.
Like you say, it's just, I mean, it's astonishing, and it's so exciting to see.
I mean, for me, for young filmmakers out there, you're like, I could handle a chariot race. June Mathis did it.
Exactly.
In 1960.
And we have more technology today.
Yeah, but to have that confidence to know that you're not alone, that there's a long history of women that were writing, that were producing. One of the people I'm thrilled, I really fought for her, is Betty Comden and Adolph Green.
Mm-hmm.
Part, you know, undeniably the greatest musical
duo.
You know, duo, writing duo of all time. And again, what you have to understand with a movie, even, you know, I see it with fresh eyes, Singing in the Rain, because when I have to rewatch it, now I have to watch it from the writer's point of view. And one of the interesting things I learned about Singing in the Rain was that they, you know, so they, it's an original story and original screenplay. So that means they were handed, they're, it's like an old movie. They're handed 20 songs. Here's the title, kids. It's called Singing in the Rain. And they had to invent that story. You know, it wasn't like, they weren't adapting it. So they had to come up with a story that could handle the 20 songs and transition them, and also, you know, make it a vehicle for, you know, for Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds and Donald O'Connor. And I mean, no easy feat. And they did The Bandwagon. So if you don't think Singing in the Rain is the greatest musical of all time, how about
it is.
The Bandwagon? So she's incredible. And just the variety of the stories of the women, I think are going to be great. Another, I mean, listen, I could go on and on. J. Preston Allen, another who not only wrote Marnie and worked with Hitchcock, but then does Prince in the City, all men, with Sidney Lumet. So again, like, who is to say, you know, when next time a person says, well, it's really like a man's movie, male vehicle. You're like, well, what about J. Preston Allen and Prince of the City? And you'll knock them flat.
There you go.
There's my, I'm going to get off my soapbox
okay.
now.
Okay. Let's bring Julianne in.
Please. I can't wait. I'm so excited. Julianne is, of course, best known, I guess, for her role as Betsy Kettleman on Better Call Saul. We love Better Call Saul here. But she's also been in the films Hitch, and she's currently in the show Preacher. Please welcome Julianne Emery. Thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a big fan of your work.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Well, that's it. Okay, have a good day, everyone.
And scene.
I said at the beginning, I love bangs. Like, I'm obsessed with bangs.
I love my bangs. And I love having short hair. I cut it for before Fargo, and I'm never going back. Oh, I like the bangs. I like the short hair. I like that. Yeah.
Are you going to do the roadshow of Chicago playing Roxy?
Right.
Because you're literally like
look
dead
is
on.
Perfect.
I can't. You look like I don't think I can dance well enough to play Roxy. My husband is like a Broadway singer. He does all of that stuff. Yeah. But I did do Chicago in I didn't play Roxy. I was just one of the girls. I was the one. I stabbed my husband 10 times. I was that girl.
Yeah.
In Summerstock, in my very first professional acting job was.
Chicago?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I love Chicago's great.
We did four shows in rotating rep, and one of them was Chicago, and I played Huddle in Fiddler on the Roof, and we did Pajama Game. I can't remember what the fourth one was.
These are great. Okay, yeah. I'm going to ask you about everybody knows I'm obsessed with musicals. So I was just talking before you got here about Singing in the Rain and what, you know.
And it was just at the Hollywood Bowl, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an incredible musical. For me, it's a fight between that and The Bandwagon. And they're written by the same person, which I never kind of...
Interesting. Not as many people know about The Bandwagon.
I know. Yeah. I am. So I'm always torn. They're both fantastic stories, different kinds of dancing.
If you're into movie musicals, one of my favorites as a kid was Calamity Jane. Do you know this?
Yeah.
With Doris Day.
Of course.
I just flew in from the windy city. Yeah. I mean, I'm still obsessed with it. I could still sit down and watch it today and be very happy.
No, I love musicals. I'm so glad that they kind of came back in vogue. There was that period in the 80s where I'm like, it is not a musical. Okay,
no.
That's like, okay, you're dancing on a rooftop.
But speaking of which, the movie musical version of Chicago, I think, is one of the best we've ever had. I thought they did it so effectively.
Fantastic.
And they did. And it's a show that I would not think would naturally lend itself to film because the show is so sketch. It's so sort of vaudeville.
Yeah.
It's very representative. It's not a literal storytelling. But they really, really made it work in a beautiful way, I thought.
What about do you watch the live? They've been a little hit or miss.
Yeah, they're hit or miss. They're just hit or miss. They're so hit or miss that I question the art form of doing it live. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what the fun is of doing it live. I guess it's sort of like a Broadway show.
It's kind of like hedging in between. Like it's on stage, but it's not. And I would almost rather them like use those same sound stages and just film it in a great way instead of trying to do it like.
Yeah, because you were mentioning the Hollywood Bowl. When they do a show at the Hollywood Bowl for a night, it's always amazing.
My husband did Freddie and My Fair Lady there with John Lithgow and several years ago. And he did Camelot there. And
they're fantastic.
They're wonderful.
For anyone who doesn't, not into musicals, if you go see those experiences at the Hollywood Bowl, I think are just such a part of the L.A., you know,
experience. And they sound amazing. Obviously, the orchestra's amazing, but the voices are amazing. They're just incredibly well done. And that's something that could go wrong, you know, because you're in front of an orchestra.
Yes.
They put everyone in costume, but they use some set pieces, but not full sets. But somehow it's...
Is that like a bus and truck where they do like an edited... Is that what's called a
Have
bus
you ever
and
done
truck?
A bus... I've done a bus and truck. Have you ever done a bus and truck?
Bus
and trucks are rough.
I think I have. Is that where you go in for 3 weeks or...
Well, the bus and truck I've done two tours early in my career. One of them we did week by week, so we flew everywhere.
Uh-huh.
But classically, you know, on the musical theater side of the business, you call a bus and truck, because you literally get on a bus from place to place. So we did split weeks. So we would do like you know, on Sunday or night, we would travel somewhere. And then on Wednesday, we would travel somewhere and we'd get off the bus and, and you know, do a quick tech and do a show Wednesday night.
Wow.
So it's kind of rough. It's not ideal, but it's, I mean, I feel like it's one of those rites of passage.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I thought what I did was I did the Music Man because it's a funny movie called Pittsburgh. Uh-huh. And Jeff Goldblum wanted to do the Music Man. And in order for him to be in it, to do it, because they didn't want him, he got all of his friends to be in it. So I was in it, and Ned Begley was in it.
That's amazing.
We turned it into a movie, like an improv movie.
Who did you play?
I played Mrs. Shin, the mayor.
Yeah, sure. I've done Music Man. Sure, absolutely.
Pick a little more. When I was a child, I was Zanita at the, I think the Avon Music Makers or something. We're going to be the all musical show. I'm going to get to musicals, but I want to go back to my favorite question. You grew up in Tennessee.
I grew up in a small town in Tennessee. Yeah. My dad had a dairy farm and.
I love it. Did you get up at 4?
Sometimes. I mean, for a period of my life. Yeah. We would get up and get the cows up to milk and. I had a horse. I got my first horse when I was 5 and promptly named her after my best friend in kindergarten.
Were you into Misty of Shinkantig?
Yes. I read every horse book I could get my hands on. Anything with a horse in it, I was into. Every horse series. And I so desperately wanted to be Laura Ingalls Wilder on Little House on the Prairie. I just thought I was her.
What is it with girls and horses? I had a pony, and then I had a half pony, half horse.
Uh-huh.
Which I didn't even know that existed, but he was a little graduated up. Or maybe he was just a small horse or something.
Maybe.
A gelding.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
There's a really special relationship there, though, between a horse and a kid. I love to ride still now, and there's a special relationship with a horse, period. But there's something interesting about a horse and a kid. I don't know how to describe it. It's not like having a dog. It's not like it's not like having a pet. It's a different kind of relationship.
Well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that you really have to care for them. I mean, I know, you have to get up before. So it was quite a commitment.
Yes.
You know, it was like, if you get this horse, you know, you're.
I had to saddle my own from the time I was 7 or 8. So I would stand on a fence and I'd put it on and get it all. And my dad would come and tighten everything, so the saddle wouldn't fall off. But we were really required to work for it. Yeah.
So do you remember my favorite question? Do you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
I'm pretty sure the first movie I saw was animated. Mm-hmm. It was The Fox and the Hound.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, it was a very special treat. My mom took us to Knoxville, which is 90 miles away, to the city, and we spent the night in a hotel. We saw the movie, and we spent the night in a hotel, and we came back. So it was a big event in our house. We did have a movie theater in my hometown, the Capri Twin, and but it didn't have kid movies very often. The first live action movie I think I saw there was Empire Strikes Back, which was obviously like life shattering. But I don't think that's where I mean, the movie theater was cool for me, but I think my love of the art form was born because my stepdad was a school teacher, and in the same year he bought a Laserdisc, a Betamax, and a VHS player. And on snow days, that's all we did was watch movies.
Yeah.
And that's where I discovered old movie musicals. And he would just bring all kinds of stuff, Casablanca, and all the way up to, all of the James Bond movies. And we watched such a wide range. There was a movie called The Greatest Show on Earth that was about the circus.
Of course.
I was obsessed with that movie.
Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah. It was I think that's where my love of it really was born. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it was born in the movie theater, which seems weird. But.
So did you imagine yourself like that? Did you gravitate first to musicals, do you think, or to acting, or you just wanted to be in show business?
I don't think the only theater for 100 miles was in my hometown. Mm-hmm. And it was, they had 5 people on staff who were non-union pros, and they would play all the leads, and then the rest of it was community theater. I don't think I considered it an option until when I was 16, I did my first play with them. They provided, the theater got an education grant, And part of that grant was that a member of their staff would teach a drama class at my high school. And mm-hmm. so it was the first drama class at our high school, and the drama teacher heard me sing in the choir and recruited me to audition for her play, and then took me to the Playhouse to audition for plays. Mm-hmm. And that's where I discovered acting. I don't think without that theater, I don't think I would have gravitated that way. I don't think it just didn't occur to me that that was an option for someone like me. I mean, I was right. a farm kid. I mean, it just wasn't, I'm the only person in my family in the business. I'm mm-hmm. not, I don't, it just was very foreign. It just seemed like something magical to me that wasn't real life.
And what was the first song you sang?
In a musical? Yeah. Or I sang a lot at church from the time I was little. But in a musical, the first song I sang was not a full song. I played Moonbeam McSwine and Little Abner. And I carried a pig. And because Tennessee,
show,
right?
Show stopping.
Yeah, but the moment I knew I wanted to be an actor was... my junior year, my teacher cast me against type to play Rizzo in Grease.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was a really good part. I was a really good girl. Like, yeah, I was yeah. kind of walking around Sandy. Like, everyone yeah. thought I would be Sandy. And she cast me as Rizzo because she thought it would be good for me. And good for her, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this woman changed my life. Her name is Mel Michelle. She teaches at Clarion College in Pennsylvania now. And she literally plucked me up and changed my life. And there was a moment during Rizzo's big song, Worst Things I Could Do, when yeah. I was standing on stage at the Playhouse in my hometown, and I was playing this character very, very different from myself. Mm-hmm. And there was this moment in between, like a resting moment, when I knew the audience was with me. Like, I knew I was inside her, and I knew the audience was with me, and that was it for me from that
right.
moment. I thought, oh my gosh, they're with me. Yeah. Like, they're inside this mm-hmm. with me in a, I don't know, in a woman that I didn't find anything relatable to when I first right. read it, and mm-hmm. it was the moment for sure.
That's always like such an interesting moment because you feel that, but do you share it with anyone, or do you just kind of, it's like,
no, I don't. I mean, I didn't talk about it at the time. It was profound for me at the yeah. time. I would lay in bed at night and think about it, and aww. it was really well, because for a kid where I was from, making the statement, I'm going to be an actor, was,
right.
I mean, that's kind of like saying I'm going to be the Jolly Green Giant. It wasn't a natural progression. Like, right. how do you even go about that? But it was profound, but I didn't talk about it mm-hmm. as the moment itself at the time. I mean, I remember pretty soon after that, my mom was like, we should start looking at colleges for you. And that's mm-hmm. when I said, I think I want to go to theater school.
Right.
And there was an awareness then. She talks about that moment now. Mm-hmm. Like the artistic director of the theater after the show came running down to meet me. She talks about the impact of that moment on the audience and right. how, like, the people at that theater mm-hmm. saw me differently after that. And I think her witnessing that moment mm-hmm. made her take it seriously as well. And mm-hmm. Made her maybe think it could happen. I don't know what I don't know why either of us thought it could actually happen, but
yeah.
But she kind of went on that journey with me.
So this is always interesting. So you have this like little bit of thought, like wind beneath your sails, and then right. what happens? Like when you're like, oh, I suck.
There's it happened like really
100
quickly.
Yeah. People that have had the exact uh-huh. same. They did. Yeah. They were Rizzo in their
yeah.
school. And
so I went.
Talk about that.
My mom part. Took me to all of these auditions at theater schools around, uh-huh. you know, around, I guess, not around the country, but regionally. We went to 5 or 6 schools, and I auditioned. And as part of that weekend, you usually sit on the class and you mm-hmm. see a show. And the day we went to Webster Conservatory, they took me off to do theater games and some mock classes and to do the auditions for them. Mm-hmm. And they took my mom off and she did all of the parent stuff. And I was so blown away. I mean, people had resumes and headshots. I didn't even know what that was. When I got the material, even to audition, I looked at it and went to the theater in my hometown and I said, I need a monologue and something called a Shakespeare monologue. I didn't even know how to pronounce it. And I mean, oh, God bless God. Them. They didn't laugh at me. They were like, it's a monologue and okay, we can do that. They, aww. You know, they were, I didn't even know what a monologue was.
Yeah.
So going to that school and auditioning with all these kids who had who'd done commercials and theater right. in New York and professional jobs. We left there, and my mom wanted to take a picture on the front steps of the school, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't let her because I said, I'll never get in here, and it'll just make me sad.
Aww.
But then I did get in there.
Oh, see?
I did. Mom I got in. Right. I did, yeah. I don't know how I got in, but I got in.
So then once you went, did you go, so once you got through school, did you go to New York first or Los Angeles?
I went to, I married my college sweetheart, mm-hmm. not right after school, but mm-hmm. He was from Chicago. So we went to Chicago for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I highly recommend that. I got all of my union cards. We worked. I understudied every leading lady in Chicago. Mm-hmm. He understudied every leading man in Chicago. And then right about the time where we both started booking roles mm-hmm. in theater there, he booked Les Mis on Broadway. And so that kind of moved us to New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have been
intense.
That's like a Star Is Born.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't feel like a Star Is Born, but uh-huh. it was, I mean, the Chicago scene for someone like me was insanely helpful because I didn't have any footing in the business. I didn't understand the business. I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And that really is a community there. So right. once you're in a show, it's a kind community. And that's a community there where in one show someone will play the lead and, you know, win a Jeff Award for it. And then two shows later, they'll be in the ensemble. Like mm-hmm. everybody there is putting a living together. And because of that, I think there's a real dedication to ensemble and a real mm-hmm. dedication to the piece at hand. Nobody's really getting famous in Chicago. Like, right. you might get Chicago famous, but mm-hmm. It makes you look at the project differently. Mm-hmm. And I think I carry that with me still. I think it gives you a good working handle on artistically, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I read that you said you your best thing would be that to be thought of as a journeyman.
Yeah, I'm a journeyman actor. Yeah, I don't know if that I don't know if I think that's like the best thing I could be thought of, but I think that's the truth. I think I am a journeyman actor. I've never been considered A-list in any way, shape, or form. I'm one of those girls who tests for the lead and everything while they go right. get a name to play it, which is right. but I think in my heart I'm a journeyman actor. I think I like transformation. I like the idea of crawling inside someone's head and figuring mm-hmm. them out. Like, it was my favorite thing about Better Call Saul is that I did not understand Betsy Cuttleman when I read her.
Uh-huh.
I did not think I was right for it at all. It wasn't who I saw in my head. And I thought, oh, I'll just make this work on me and maybe they'll see me for something else down the yeah. road. But I like, you know, when I was in my freshman year of college, since we've been talking about college, I came home and my papa, Stowers, asked me what I was learning at that weirdo yeah. Yankee theater school.
What are you learning?
And I went into this big thing about Uta Hagen and Boleslavsky and yeah. the Magic If and all of that kind of stuff. And I talk for 20 minutes and he looks at me and he goes, ah, you're learning to walk around in somebody else's shoes. I reckon that's all right. That's all right thing to know. And it was really profound, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's a really profound statement on what we do.
Yeah.
And it stuck with me. And I think I like trying on a lot of shoes. I like crawling in a lot of different minds.
Yes.
And figuring out how they work.
Yeah. So then now when you're in New York, is that when does Hitch come? Because I wanted to talk about Hitch because I
yeah. find it, Hitch came. I was in New York.
Is that like your first sort of big break?
Yeah, I had been, I'd come to L.A. to do a series that was had a brief life. And I booked Hitch right after the series. Mm-hmm. But that was a big, I'd never done a studio movie. I'd done some little indie films.
Yeah.
That was a big break for me. And I was like number 5 on the call sheet. And that was a big hairy deal. And I was used to flying below the radar, and I did not fly below the radar during right. that process. I was, you know, high enough up to
So is that the kind of movie? It reminded me a little bit of a movie I did called Picture Perfect.
Oh, yeah, I love that movie, and you're great in it.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I used to joke because, like, Jennifer Aniston had two buses, and then Kevin had a bus, and then Jay had a bus, and then I was, like, on 42nd Street. You know, it was really,
Will had, like, a two double-decker trailer, right?
Yeah.
And then behind that, a full trailer, a whole trailer that was a gym.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And in New York, that's a whole block. You know? So.
Okay, you're confirming.
Yes, and I was in like a little triple banger, you know, like with the day players, you know, with like, but.
So was it intense? So my question is, so is it, because even though I was famous when I did the movie, it still felt like, oh, this is a big studio film.
Right.
There's a lot of money riding on this. A lot of careers are riding on this.
Yep.
And I used to have to just walk to the set and kind of keep my head held high and keep a foot in, you know, keep my confidence up. Did you have that? Did you feel that?
Yeah, a lot of, you know, this is going to sound like a weird thing to say because I'm so grateful to be part of Hitch. And it was a huge learning experience for me. And I love how the movie turned out. I think it's delightful. But the period of time shooting Hitch felt like a creative panic attack to me for several reasons, one of which, our first table read, my little nameplate was across the table from Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 months earlier, I waited on him in a restaurant.
Tell him?
Not until later.
Oh.
Because I was too freaked out. I thought I should tell him. But I remember sitting there going, this is a nice moment. And then I thought, don't mess this up. This is, you know, like it immediately it was a really nice moment. And then it was like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
The movie also, there was a laundry list of people doing rewrites on the movie that aren't credited.
Right.
And they included all of my favorite comedy writers. I mean, it was like Ken Lonergan and Lowell Ganz and Pablo Mandel. And I mean, and they would, every time we did a table read, they'd all be lined up.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Wall. And so that was intense.
Mm-hmm.
My character changed immensely over time. When I auditioned for the character, she was totally different. And then I started talking to Andy Tennant. Sweet Home Alabama had just come out, the director, and we chatted for a while about being from Tennessee and how my family loved Sweet Home Alabama. And I left the room and got my big puffy coat on, and I was at the elevators, and his assistant came running out and was like, Julianne, come back in. And I went back in, and he's like, just throw your coat on the ground. Like, it felt like one of those weird Hollywood moments where everything's too important for 5 minutes, you know? And I threw my coat on the ground, and I go back in, and they're like, could you do it again and be that cute Southern girl that you just were just now? And I was like, okay. And I looked at the sides and I looked at him, and he's like, you can change the words. It's okay. So I did that. And I think they didn't know who the character was and what they needed from her and what they really needed from her. The female lead was a gossip columnist and not necessarily nice. And what they needed from that Casey was to make her likable. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't think they had a sense of that. So my role changed immensely rewrite by rewrite. So I was trying to keep up with that as well. And then the script continued to get rewritten in an overall way. Like the last third of the movie kept changing. So we would do these table reads every couple of weeks.
Right.
And also on a daily basis. There was one shoot day that I got my script the night before.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else happened on the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and usually not at the top of the day. Usually they would light whatever space we were in for a wide shot, and we would have no pages because they were rewriting and getting approvals and sending to Sony. And then they would put them in our hands as we were walking to set, and we would cold read the blocking rehearsal. So, and then go from there and try to make it through the scene. So and I wasn't playing myself.
Right.
So I was trying to kind of match up a consistent character, and the movie felt like a creative panic attack. I just kept thinking, don't screw this up, don't screw this up, don't screw this up, you know.
Did it feel like with somebody like Will Smith that he was aware of that, like, is it Will Smith that they're worried about? Is it Kevin James? Is it the whole movie?
Well, it
was
Kevin's first big movie. Kevin was doing King of Queens, but this was his first big move into film. It wasn't Will necessarily. I just think that the script wasn't ready when we started shooting.
Right.
And I think Andy knew it. And so there was, I think, a battle between Andy and Sony and getting approvals and all of that kind of stuff. So I think Andy is really good at this kind of movie, at the romantic comedy genre. He knows what to do with women. I think it was a romantic comedy with a male lead at the center of it, mm-hmm. and that made everybody nervous. Mm-hmm. It was Will Smith's first time doing a romantic comedy, and most of his comedy was on television.
Right.
So I think it just wasn't ready when we started. I think they knew that. They pushed the start date for a while, and we would just do table reads like 3 times a week, and then they would do these massive rewrites. And so I don't know why it went down exactly how it did, but it was intense.
Yeah.
Especially for a first studio film. It was not... I mean, on the one hand, it was crazy intense. On the other hand, I'd been doing TV, so I was used to, like, a certain amount of rewriting and making choices on the fly. But it was – I didn't necessarily – I thought, gosh, does every big studio movie go this way?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you wonder if that tension – I feel it does in some ways because, as I said, I watched the movie. I'm always fascinated by watching movies. I'm like –
How did this go
like
down?
Three
right?
movies, mm-hmm. and what is like, what's happening now? Like, this seems improvisational. This seems very tight. This, you know, I had certain reservations. As I said, I felt like it was a duality of the two female leads.
Right.
That it was kind of like, you know, the same chord in a sense.
Well, I mean, I think Will was powerful enough that Will's scenes they were perfectly happy to let be improvised. But then when it came to Eva and I, they were like, you missed the word "the" in that sentence. And I'm like, you're kidding, right? Because there's a lot happening here and you just handed me the script. So maybe, you know. So I think that is a
tension.
Reality. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I think I always felt like it was a miracle the movie came out in a coherent way, although I think Andy always had a handle on it somewhere in his head.
Yeah.
But...
I can't imagine the pressure.
Yeah.
As I said, I've been in these situations, and I just look at the director, and I'm like, I'm here, boss.
Yeah, what do you need? Because I don't know what's happening anymore. Yeah.
It's funny you say that, because I was like, I bet he was leaning on you. He
leaned on me hard.
Now I know, because they look for someone that's out of the mix.
Yes, because he would come to me. He wasn't... I don't mean leaned on me hard in a mean way, but if the scene wasn't working... He didn't go to Eva.
No.
He would come to me and say, it's not working. What do you got?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd have to come up with something. I mean, you know, so it's... And I realize that is sort of part of doing a comedy. They do rely on you to a certain degree if they get in trouble to help them out.
Yes.
But I was so green in the feature world, and I'd been doing all this dramatic television. I did a lot of comedy on stage, but I didn't... You know, it wasn't necessarily what... I didn't know how far to step in that direction. You know, I wasn't... Now I would handle that situation differently. That said, it was one of the nicest casts I've ever worked with. And I think a lot of that movie works because the cast genuinely liked each other and genuinely spent time with each other and thought each other were decent human beings. So I think there's a relationship level that plays, even between Kevin and Will... And between Eva and I, that has had more to do with...
Yeah.
And you know, that has had more to do with the experience of it and us hanging out together and all of us panicking together all the time.
Right.
Than the movie itself. I mean, you know, when you're in that situation, a stressful situation like that, you either really bond or you never want to see each other again.
Well, when you're doing a comedy, you got to create an environment where people can be funny. And so it sounds like if there's tension. Okay, now, then you have a 180-degree different experience of Fargo, which seems like totally artistic... Like the best of indie sensibility, complete artistic freedom. Am I correct?
I was in the TV series.
Yes.
So like it was Fargo, season one of Fargo was interesting because nobody remembers this, but when they announced that, when FX announced they were doing a TV series of Fargo.
Uh-huh.
The internet was horrible about it. Nobody thought it was a good idea. Everyone thought it was a terrible idea. And they talked about how many ways that the network was going to screw it up.
Uh-huh.
So everyone who jumped onto season one of Fargo jumped on because Noah Hawley's scripts were just brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, they just thought the characters were that interesting and the scripts were that brilliant. And if it was going to go down, you may as well go down doing something where you like the writing and, yeah. and the scripts, right? So it's a big testament. I mean, I think Billy Bob was the first person that came mm-hmm. on and that kind of got it greenlit. But everyone that jumped on just because they liked it. Mm-hmm. And we shot the first two episodes, and then in November, December, and we shut down for a month, and they fully edited the first episode, and they showed it in full at the TCAs in January. Mm-hmm. And then the whole world changed.
Wow.
So before shooting, I was there for prep for the first two episodes, because my stuff just happened to be shooting on the first 2 days. And there was a lot of stress and tension over where the dialect should sit and over what the tone was, because it's Fargo, but it's like Fargo meets No Country for Old Men. I mean, it's much darker than the movie. Mm-hmm. It wasn't nearly as free comedically as the movie, but that was something they were trying to find their footing on. And so we would have these rehearsals. I had never been pregnant, and I was hugely pregnant. So I would ask. We had rehearsals every day and dialect coaching every day. So I would go early and get into the giant belly, because I didn't want my first day to be lost to how do I maneuver this pregnancy thing. I wanted it to, I wanted to focus on other things. So I'd walk around the production offices all day in a giant pregnancy belly. And we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and all the MGM people were there. Two of the development people from FX were there, like, not for a couple of days, for like the whole first 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I think that was anxiety. Mm-hmm. And then in January, once the TCAs happened, the Twitter kind of exploded. The critics all kind of flipped for it, and then the whole world changed, and everybody mm-hmm. kind of relaxed and started kind of doing their work. But no actor on everybody showed up on that set prepared. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to suck on Fargo,
right?
And nobody wanted to be the asshole on Fargo. Everybody was well behaved and nice, and it really felt like an environment where everyone was serving the piece, which I hadn't mm-hmm. had since Chicago.
Right.
I hadn't had that. It felt like that kind of ensemble experience again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who was the director on that? You mentioned the writer.
Adam, it was different directors.
For each episode.
Yeah. Adam Bernstein directed the first two episodes. Colin Buxy directed one who, he won the Emmy for that, mm-hmm. For that season. And I've worked with him since. I'm trying to think. Frankly, a lot of our best directors in television were working on Fargo because, again, they liked the scripts.
Right.
And they were doing the shooting style. Dana Gonzalez does the cinematography, and he was there season one as well. And he talked about, you can give them all of the interesting wide shots you want, but if they edit it like a TV series, then it doesn't matter. But they didn't edit it like a TV series. They really let the pace sit slow, mm-hmm. which nobody was used to on that set. Nobody was used, because television just tended to go fast.
Right.
I think that's changing a little now, mm-hmm. but the pace of TV at that time was West Wing. Everything was West Wing pace, and this felt very different. And it didn't feel like the movie of Fargo either. It felt mm-hmm. kind of interesting. There's a shot in the second episode, I think it's the second episode, where in the emergency room between Martin Freeman and Billy Bob Thornton, mm-hmm. and they're sitting, and Martin is waiting for them to help him with his nose, and they edited the whole thing in a weird two shot, like from down here mm-hmm. up and across them. And I remember watching it for the first time thinking, oh, they're going to cut in. Oh, they're going to cut in. And then they didn't. And I was like, oh, I am in such a cool thing. Like, it's interesting how, like, just that, how much of that plays in post, mm-hmm.
Well, editing is such an important thing, because, again, like, our sort of our traditional editing that can be so quick, and like you said, it's more European to let things kind of draw out. All right, so now we have to get to Betsy Kettleman, another iconic performance that you can hang your hat on.
Betsy's a little cuckoo. I hesitate to say that. I'm far enough. I mean, I don't like to ever have judgment on my characters, but I don't, we talked about crawling inside different people's heads. I think that's important in our world, period, because we're in a moment where we don't understand each other and seem to not have a desire to. But like, you know, Betsy odd. Is, you know, when we were shooting season one, the governor of Virginia and his wife were getting indicted for taking, you know, $250,000 in bribes. And there was the Bell County scandal that NPR was doing this whole series on out here in Los Angeles. And where they were, you know, city councilmen were taking $250,000 a year while there wasn't enough money for water in the schools, or for like anything. And they really didn't think they did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And we really latched onto that in the first episode. And we got lucky because the characters were not supposed to stick around that long and they weren't supposed to be that big. Mm-hmm. They were just supposed to be kind of a point of tension between Jimmy McGill and the big law firm HHM. Mm-hmm. But we got into these really interesting character discussions and discussions about what that is, and they went back and redid their boards for the characters and turned them into what they were. We got lucky that they were able to do that, you know, that Vince and Peter had Breaking Bad and had kind of enough power at the studio to do that, mm-hmm. and that they were willing because it caused a lot of work for the writers.
Well, usually when a writer starts, because I always think a television show is sort of like an amoeba. It just sort of, it's, you think it's this, and then now it's becoming this.
Yeah.
But so there must have been some quality that he saw in you, or something interest to counterbalance.
I didn't, you know, I'll tell you what happened in my own mind. I didn't think I was right for it. I never thought they would cast me in it. When I was sitting on set my first day of shooting at Loyola's Diner across from Bob Odenkirk, and we had longer to shoot the first episode, mostly because Vince was directing and Sony was just happy to still have him around. Mm-hmm. And so we did do a lot of character work that day, which you never get to do on a TV set. But I was looking at Bob at one point and I went, oh, he's the kooky character on Breaking Bad, but he's the lead in this. Mm-hmm. Someone has to be crazier than him to make him look normal. I was like, I'm here to make him look normal. Mm. And that, from that moment on, I really understood who she was. But I don't think I really understood her till then, nor did I understand why they cast me. Neither did Jeremy Sheamus, who plays Mr. Kettleman. And we spent some time together before shooting in Albuquerque trying to figure out who these people were and what they wanted from them, because there's really like 1.5 scenes in the first episode. Mm-hmm. And finally, we had both submitted self-tapes for the audition because we'd both been in New York mm-hmm. when they were auditioning. And one night we had a drink and we watched each other's audition tapes.
Oh my God.
I know, which feels like getting naked in front of someone, right? I mean, you're an actor. Nobody understands that except other actors.
Oh yeah, that's horrifying.
It was horrifying, right? It was horrifying, but it was the only thing we could think of to do. And it worked because we went, oh, because we saw how we fit together.
Right.
So it kind of made us feel like we understood what they saw and the direction they wanted to push it. Because every time we asked a producer or a writer, they were just like, no, just do what you did in your audition. And both of us were like, what did we do in our audition that was... Yeah, but we saw like the quality that worked together, mm-hmm. and we learned a lot, but it was hard. It was really hard to do that.
So what do you do when you're on set and you get stuck? I mean, I've certainly had this. I'm like, oh my God, this is bad. I don't have the accent, and we're filming it right now. Like, do you panic?
How do you handle that?
There was only one.
I have that moment of pull it together, Emery, or this is really going to go bad.
We're shooting something. Yeah. I mean, there was only one time in my entire life, and that was on the set of Alive. I said, I don't have it. I'm asking you, can we pick this? Can we do a wide shot? And we'll pick it up tomorrow. And reluctantly, the director agreed to it. But I knew that emotionally, it was so hard. I didn't have it. It was like, it was my death scene. And I was like, we'll do the wide shot and we'll do his coverage. And please, God, please do my close-up tomorrow. And he did it. But I've rarely done that. Other times you just like,
Takes guts to do, and good for you for doing it. I don't think I've ever had the guts to quite do
like,
that.
We were like, oh my God, I have to cry now. There's a difference between
I don't have the scene between comedy and drama, right? I mean, emotionally, sometimes...
You're stuck. You look across the room, they're like going like this.
Yeah. I read an interview once with a woman, and I can't remember who it was. It was someone like Michelle Pfeiffer or something, and they were like, how do you prepare for like an emotional scene? And they were like, you prepare and then you wake up and you pray that the acting gods are with you. Mm-hmm. Because some days you're just more emotionally available than others in life and also in work. That's my experience. And right. I mean, emotionally speaking, I try to start changing up my triggers. Mm-hmm. That's a geeky actor talk. Or just looking for anything. And sometimes if I open myself up to the possibility that, oh, just because it says cry, like what happens if it's not?
Right.
What happens if it's empty? What happens if it is this or that or this? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that opens it up. But the biggest emotional crutch for me is my husband is so comforting. This is so embarrassing. I can't believe I'm saying this out loud. If I don't think I have it, if I call him and I'm like, honey, we're about to shoot my emotional scene, I don't have it. It's such a shameful crutch, and I have absolutely used it. I've absolutely, and he's like, it's okay, sweetie. It's okay if it doesn't go well. And I'm like, thank you. And then, like,
action.
Like, but comedically, that's a different thing. Like, yeah. Comedically, if you're just trying and, you know, if you're trying and it's not working and it's not working, and you know it's not working.
Right. Things that get me stuck are, when you're preparing and then the prop person says, can you try not to pour all of the orange juice?
Or don't tap the keys on the computer.
And I go I'm like, thank you. My entire preparation just went out because now all I'm... So usually when I know enough that I must step out of the scene and I must say, give me a minute here.
Yep.
Just give me a minute. Because I absolutely know that if they're going to shoot it, I do not have it. And I have to be...
I do stop looking people in the eye, which is, I do like to make friends with the crew. I like to feel like we're all in it together. And on emotional days, if we're in that scene, if we're between shots or between setups, I let them touch me up, but I stay somewhere in the thoughts of the character.
Yeah.
Like, I don't try to stay emotionally there because then you're just wasting it. But I try to, and if props comes and talks to me, I'm not sure when that developed. I don't look at them. I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, I try to, like, keep it, like, a third-party voice out there somewhere. Like, if I fully break out and engage with them, right, it's just gone. There's a certain, you know, it's so funny because I always try to break acting down to the most practical, regular means. But because the business thinks there's so much hoodoo in it, you know, but there is a certain amount of hoodoo in an emotional scene, and you can lose it really quickly.
Oh.
I also will not talk to people about what my triggers are.
Yeah.
And I don't like to talk to people about how I load my homework. Like, I like to build out my character's life.
Yeah.
And I have a writer director that I work with quite often, and he's asked me more than once to look at my character notebook, and I won't show it to him because I feel like it's my mojo. You know,
I want to look at it. That's terrible.
Because he's curious. Because he's building out the character as well, and he's curious what I'm putting into it. But I don't. I'm not interested in that. Like, I'm interested in where my work meets his. Like, I need those things. I don't know. I feel like I need them to be private. If I share them with anybody, then they stop working for me.
No, he'll start thinking about it. I once auditioned for Ron Howard, and he spent an hour asking me, like, and how did you do this moment? How did you do this moment? I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. He's so interested in me. And I literally lost the part. Like, I think as I left the next day, I was like, I told him too much. He should have thought it was mysterious, and now he knows the tricks, and it's just, you know, sometimes it's just tricks.
Sometimes it's just tricks, and sometimes it loses the magic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm most terrified it'll lose the magic for me. Like, that I won't have, because we all have secrets that we walk into any room with, and we all have our own baggage and our own history we walk into a room with, but we don't tell everybody that when we walk in the room. Hi, my parents got divorced when I was 7, and it really left a mark on me. Like, we don't, like, talk about those things, but they're important.
I know. I hate when they talk to you beforehand, when you're, like, loaded for bear, you're like, don't talk to me.
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have much time left, so I want to get to Preacher. And what is that experience? I was watching you at Comic-Con.
Comic-Con is crazy.
I know. It's just crazy. I've never been. I'm afraid.
I'm a sci-fi geek. So Comic-Con was like overstimulation for me.
Yeah.
You know, Preacher is a double sword for me because I am a sci-fi fan. I was a fan of Preacher season one. So, like, going to Comic-Con was wildly cool. And there's this whole aspect of being on Preacher that is thrilling for me. Like, it almost feels like an outside experience. But Featherstone as a role is probably the best role I've had in my career. There's a transformational aspect to the character that is... like a dream. I couldn't write a better role for myself in terms of that. And so, like, and our cast is very high end. I mean, I spent the last half of the season in a big storyline with Ruth Negga, who's nominated for an Oscar, and I, you know, Pip Torrens. I mean, our cast is full of people who have I've admired their work for a long time. So there's a high watermark moment to moment, but the show itself is absurd, right? I mean, the circumstances are absurd, but it's grounded. So It's weird. Like, it's not, it doesn't feel like, I don't know, I was always like, what would it feel like to be in a Star Wars movie or something I was a huge fan of?
I know. You bring it back to Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Like, it, and I think it's, you know, Preacher feels like something I could fangirl over, but it's, the work itself is grounded. And, I mean, Sam Catlin is our showrunner, and he was, you know, on Breaking Bad and came from that world. And, there's Michael Slovis is our producing director, and he, you know, was a cinematographer on Breaking Bad and then has directed all of our high-end television. Like, you don't want to let anybody down. Like, I spend a lot of time on Preacher wanting to live up to it, and the role is so great. And then there's this other side of it where comic book fans are intense, you know? We were in Hall H at Comic-Con. People spent the night in line to get in there. And I mean, we were there when it was Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, Twin Peaks, us, and Marvel's The Defenders. It was, and it's over 6,000 seats.
Yeah.
And it's gigantic and overwhelming and weird and crazy. And
I know. It's a, when my era, it was just Trekkies and stuff. And now it's like, it's taken very, very, very seriously.
Yeah. And it's very, San Diego Comic-Con, I'm curious about other conventions because San Diego Comic-Con is very industry-oriented now. Like, there's like, you know, Spider-Man dolls everywhere. The Batmobile was there, and it is very commercial now. So it used to be like you have to kind of go there. My two favorite areas of the main floor is there's an area that's still just old school comic book sellers,
which is
how the con started in the first place. And then there's an area for the artists.
Yeah,
you know, they'll draw and stuff while you're there, and you can watch them and
Do you watch early sci-fi like Twilight Zone?
I was into the Twilight Zone. Star Trek was like my first big like television obsession, sci-fi wise. The Million Dollar Man we watched.
Six Million Dollar Man.
Thank you. The $6 Million Man.
Shows how much I know. We didn't get that channel.
Yeah. No, you didn't.
We only got CBS.
Yeah, we
were poor.
We got the main network.
My childhood was pathetic. I only got CBS. So I got Canon.
Only CBS?
Yes. This is true. This is.
We got CBS, ABC, NBC, and.
No, I had to, like, my shameful childhood was I used to have to pretend to participate in conversations about television shows that I couldn't watch.
That's not funny.
I know. But I was like, all we got was, like, Barnaby Jones and Canon, and it was horrible. It was a horrible, my parent, don't, the moral is don't have hippies for.
Well, we didn't, I mean, my town didn't have cable. So, I mean, the really rich people... By the time I was in junior high school started getting those giant satellite dishes in their backyard, but the giant ones, you know, the ones that are, you know, you could put your car inside. But I didn't know what everybody, you know, all the rich kids talked about MTV, and I had no idea what they were talking about. So then once we knew what MTV was, we would make our own music videos. To Hit Me With Your Best Shot and The Gambler.
Do you have any?
No, we did. Well, we didn't have a. Oh. Are you kidding? We didn't have a video camera. That would be classic, though.
These kids today, they don't understand.
They don't know what
they
they've got.
It's
such
iPhones.
A big deal. Even like, I remember getting a video camera in the 90s.
It was
We were like,
and that thing was heavy and big, and you had to put a full VHS tape in it.
Yeah. We were terrible on the set of Alive. We'd film each other and everything.
Awesome.
I know. I still have some crazy.
You had a long career though, like and very young. Like you were.
I started out pretty. I feel like I'm going the Ruth Gordon route. I'm like, you're gonna have to get a hook and get. I'm gonna be in my 80s, and but now I'm also writing and directing too, because acting isn't enough. I love writing and directing and stuff. Do you ever think about directing?
I do. I wrote and directed a web series. We didn't do nearly as well as your fabulous
Easy to Assemble
did, but
back in the early days.
Yeah, and I've written a couple of pilots for production companies.
That's
here.
Great.
I just signed on to direct my first feature.
That's fantastic.
We still are securing our funding, so it doesn't feel real yet. Yeah. But I think we're in a moment where women's voices are really needed and necessary. And if you're able to write, I think you have a responsibility too.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. On that note, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Please come back anytime.
You can find Julianna on Twitter.
Don't
change your hair. On Twitter and Instagram at Julianne Emery. Thank you, Julie. Also, just side note, someone told me you have the best feet in Hollywood.
What?
Really?
That's what I heard.
Okay, well, they're size six.
I just like
they're
to dispute
small.
That because I've got
you have fabulous feet.
Somebody told me. All right, the show has gotten out of control.
Since we're live, I can talk
live.
About these things. You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon. Also, like our Facebook page. The website is
IleanasPodcast.com.
It's live. It's crazy around here. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, we're going to Google search Julie.
It'll be, feet. I know
now
that's,
we're going to
have to
look
at I'm freaking out about that. Right?
I'm a little scared, too. Ileana, sorry.
There's a Wiki feet thing, right?
Oh, God.
I know.
I'm not into feet.
Feet. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
You'll take it.
I'll take it. Absolutely.
Anyway, as I like to say, as the strings should come in at this point, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of ours. Thanks so much for being here. And see you next week, guys.
Thanks,
bye.
Everybody.
Have a great day. Bye.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.